Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This week, Groundwire is produced at CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph, Ontario. I'm your host, Erin Hudson. First up, we'll be looking at the Idle No More movement. We will hear perspectives from different supporters of the movement and listen to sounds recorded at demonstrations across the country. You were just listening to music recorded at the Round Dance Revolution at Waterfront Station in Vancouver, BC, unceded Coast Salish territories. The number of actions, blockades, and rallies where people are showing their support and solidarity with the Idle No More movement are taking place all over the world. From Central America, Europe, the United States, the Middle East, Australia, South Africa, New Zealand, Indonesia, and of course, all across Canada. Now we go to a piece recorded from an Idle No More demonstration in Halifax by the media co-op's Miles Howe. The demonstration took place in December and is focusing on mobilization against the Omnibus Bill C-45.
It's such an honor for us all to gather here and to be together for such an important cause. We're all here for the BC-45 and to stand up and stand our ground. Get the smudge going here, get the spirits going. I just think it's so important for our youth to understand that this is such an important issue for us all to be educated about. You know, this is our future. I look at my little niece, she was just running by with my sister Shelly, his daughter, and I just see her and I want to see a future for her that I've been able to grow up in. I want to see her to be able to grow into a strong young First Nations and Mi'kmaq woman. With the things that will happen from the Bill C-45, she won't be able to have that strong background. She won't be able to have that stability knowing where she came from, because she won't be able to hunt. She won't be able to practice her traditional ways. And I just think that's so sad. It's so sad to see a future like that for our children, especially coming from a traditional family myself. I have my father here, my father's Alexander McDonald, and my mother's Donna Stevens, and ever since I was a little baby girl, they always raised me in a traditional family and a cultural family. I'm a dancer. I've been dancing since I was 5 years old, and just this past summer, my niece, we started her off in dancing, and it was such a proud moment for me, and I want to be able to see that for all of our First Nations people and all of our First Nations children all across Canada. To be able to know where they came from as First Nations people. And with this bill, I don't feel that we'll be able to have all of those things that make us First Nations people. And I think it's so great that people are speaking out all across Canada on this issue. And I just want you to all speak your voice, because, you know, like, I'm terrified up here, all these people staring at me, but I know that it's important to speak out on this issue, because if we don't speak now, who's going to speak for our children down the road? And who's going to fight for us down the road? Who's going to fight for our land? Who's going to fight for our culture? So I just want to say to you all today, just thank you, Wally, for coming know, and fighting for yourselves, fighting for your future, fighting for your children's future. Thank you very much.
The protest of Bill C-45 served as a starting point for the Idle No More movement. The bill includes changes to hunting and fishing rights.
Hello, my name is Jaime Batiste. I'm from the district of Unamagi. I'm glad to be here today with you. I always start off speaking my Mi'kmaq language because I grew up next to one of our Mi'kmaq role models, Grand Captain Elik Denny. And he always told me when you address public, always start off speaking Mi'kmaq. And he gave me two reasons for that. The first reason is to show that after 400 years of contact, that our language is strong and our culture is still strong within the Mi'kmaq youth. And secondly, because I'm so pale, no one would believe I was Mi'kmaq. Okay. All right, I told Morley I wouldn't tell many jokes. We're here to be angry. We're getting frustrated. Okay, that's my quota. No more jokes. Back to being angry. Okay. So one of the other things he taught me, I like how you live next door, is Jigiyaptin, Andle's father. He taught me about Nedibulink. And as Nedibulink, that means that we as Mi'kmaq are blessed with rights, but we are also bound by responsibilities. And our responsibilities are to our family, our communities, our nation, and our ecosystem. And that's why we're here today, to honor those responsibilities for our families, for our children, for the young people standing in front of me, to say that we're going to make sure that their generation has it better than ours and all of the things that our ancestors promised us in our treaties. We're here for our communities so that we don't lead in every negative statistical category that makes life sometimes unbearable in our First Nation communities. We're here for our nation, united, saying that we're going to put aside all of our differences and stand together in solidarity. And most important, well, some would say most importantly, we're here for our ecosystem to ensure that our environment and our rights will be there for the 7 generations from now. One of the things that people have said is that we are Canada's last hope in terms of stopping this government. And the reason we say that we are the last hope is because as Mi'kmaq, we have Aboriginal and treaty rights signed with the Crown, reaffirmed and recognized in the Constitution of Canada in Section 35. But there's also a clause in that Constitution that they signed called the Supremacy Clause, saying that the Constitution is the supreme law of Canada. Anything that is inconsistent is of no force and effect. That means that our treaty rights, our Aboriginal rights, trump and supersede and are more powerful than any legislation the Harper government will throw at us. And many times we have gone to court and we've won. We've won in the Simon case, our right to hunt. We've won in Marshall, our right to commercial fisheries. We've won in Sapir Gray. We've won many times in court, yet why is it that our communities continue to lead every negative statistic out there? We are here today to have our rights implemented, but if we can't get, we're talking about our Aboriginal and treaty rights, but we can't even get this government to acknowledge our basic human rights and dignity. The right to water, the right to education, the right to not be talked. But I know that we're here today to talk about Bill C-45. And while we're standing up against Bill C-45, against the amendments to the lack of protection for our environments, the lack of recognition of our livelihood right to fish, but we're also here to talk about what isn't in Bill C-45. And there isn't a thing about the illegal confiscation of our lands and resources in that bill. There isn't a thing for reconciliation for the history of colonization and assimilation they put on us. There isn't a peep about equal education funding, safe drinking water, or an inquiry into missing and murdered women in our communities. And I've seen our leaders' frustration as they talk to governments, and we've reminded them over and over, both in the Nova Scotia area and nationally, that their unilateral approach will not stand. And every time they try to pass the legislation that affects our rights, we'll be here and we're getting stronger. There's a new hope, though. I see it, and I'm glad when I was asked by the youth to speak here today. And it's because our youth have to take the lead on this. That our youth, we need their energy. We need their frustration. We need their motivation to get this thing started, because we're involved in a new Mi'kmaq renaissance, a renaissance based on education, based on unity. And I ask our youth to continue with that education and unity. I've often reminded about the seventh generation prophecy during my times with AFN, and they said that seven generations after the Europeans arrive, our youth will lead and take us to where a place of prosperity. And we're now in that seventh generation.
That was Sunshine and Clouds by Jazzpad from their digital album, Be the Sunlight. And now, here are the headlines. On December 18th, the 12th Global Day of Action Against Racism for the Rights of Migrant Workers, Refugees, and Displaced People was celebrated in communities across Canada. The group Justicia for Migrant Workers compiled a list of facts outlining the changes made to migrant workers' programs throughout 2012. These changes include the elimination of employment insurance special benefits for migrant workers, mandating differential wage regimes between migrant and non-migrant workers, an absence of protection and enforcement against recruiters and recruitment fees, and the deportation of 16,511 migrants from all categories. There are approximately 400,000 migrant workers living in Canada. Our next headline is based on a report by Media Co-op's Robert Devitt. The recent passage of the Missing Persons Act has residents of Nova Scotia concerned that the act may have unintended consequences. The act would give police quick access to personal records such as cell phone histories, internet browsing history, GPS information, employment, health, and banking records. Police would be able to access this information for the missing person and anyone who is deemed with the missing person. The act also gives police the ability to enter and search a property if they believe the missing person is present. The Canadian Civil Liberties Association and a local sex work advocacy group called Stepping Stone are among those who have raised concern with the act. They say the act frees police of the need to find evidence that a crime was likely committed before accessing such information or searching a suspected premises. Concerns were also raised with the limited consultation time that was available. The Missing Persons Act was introduced on December 3rd and became law on December 6th. And our final headline comes from Quebec. As 2012 came to a close, the provincial government announced cuts to post-secondary institutions' government funding. Many institutions react with messages released publicly and to their students opposing the cuts. Many schools felt the funding cuts would prohibit them from carrying out much of their normal operations. The provincial funding cuts come in addition to the cut of tuition fee increases. The tuition fee increases were perceived by many institutions as being a source for further funding. The tuition fee increase had been planned for September 2012. However, after the student movement's actions against the fee increases, the newly elected provincial government canceled the hike. The provincial government's cuts to funding for post-secondary institutions supports those institutions' claims that they are underfunded. That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this. And now it's time for our feature stories. Our first feature comes out of a community in northern Newfoundland called Cowhead. Cowhead residents met with representatives from the company Shoal Point Energy and were informed that the wastewater from the company's experimental fracking project would be headed to Nova Scotia for disposal. We go to an interview with Gretchen Fitzgerald, director of the Atlantic chapter of the Sierra Club, for more information.
We weren't there, but we were then sent recordings of what happened at the meeting and also transcripts. And of course, we were concerned because we're very active on the issue of fracking in general in Atlantic Canada. But then when we heard sort of the community members asking, what will you do with the waste? And it was sort of said in an offhand way, well, we're thinking of shipping it to Nova Scotia, then we became even more alarmed. It seemed like the project had not been really well thought through from that point of view. And then we're also very much engaged in trying to protect the entire Gulf of St. Lawrence from oil and gas drilling. And actually kind of the reason we knew about the project was because the strategic environmental assessment is going on for that area of Western Newfoundland to determine if oil and gas is appropriate for that area at all. The point of a strategic environmental assessment can be to look at a certain type of activity, in this case oil and gas, and what are the impacts on the region. So that's what's been going on this fall. And we do have a lot of issues with how that's being done. And I guess one of them would be the fact that they're even looking at specific projects like this fracking project when they haven't really finished their strategic environmental review at all. So, and we're also very concerned about the lack of really good public consultation that has happened as part of this. Basically, because of concerns expressed from people around the region about the prospect of oil and gas development in the Gulf, the offshore regulator for Newfoundland, which is called the Canada Newfoundland and Labrador Offshore Petroleum Board, basically wrote to our federal minister of environment saying, we've gotten more letters of concern about the prospect of developing oil and gas in this region than we've ever had in our history, and we need to do something. And in fact, they had suggested doing what's called a review panel in Canadian Environmental Assessment. And that actually would be the highest level of assessment you could have in Canada. It's done for major projects. A lot of folks will have heard of the Northern Gateway Project. That's happening out west. That level of assessment is basically one of the things that the board asked the minister for permission to do. Minister Kent unfortunately said no, but then he did say to the board, listen, you do need to do thorough consultation because of the level of concern, and one of the things you need to do was reopen something called a strategic environmental assessment. And just to give your listeners some context, we have had fracking happen here in Nova Scotia and years ago, and we're still trying to figure out what to do with the waste, and municipalities have really expressed some concerns about even taking the treated fracking waste. So the thought of more and more waste coming to Nova Scotia when we haven't really demonstrated a capacity to deal with it was really worrying to us.
The Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline project is one we hear of often from various media sources and from many communities throughout northwestern Canada. Many communities, in particular Aboriginal communities, are ardently opposed to the project. Currently, a joint review panel is traveling throughout the province of British Columbia to conduct a series of public hearings on the proposed pipeline. Though an independent body, many view the panel as an extension of the National Energy Board, as two of its three members are currently on the National Energy Board's Board of Directors. The panel is now wrapping up hearings in Victoria, British Columbia. What we're about to hear is testimony from Lee Brain, a resident of a northern British Columbia community, Prince Rupert. Brain is an after-school activities coordinator in elementary schools and the son of one of the oil industry's biggest executives. He presented in February of last year.
So I consider myself living somewhat of a hybrid life. On one hand, I'm deeply passionate about a resilient, sustainable, and flourishing planet. On the other hand, well, there's my dad. My oral evidence today comes in the form of a story, an experience I had 3 years ago, which directly reflects the impacts this project will have on me and my community. The story begins after a lifetime of debating with my father. He thought it was high time for me to finally experience firsthand the magnitude and power the oil industry has to offer. So in the summer of 2009, I had the opportunity to spend one full month on one of the world's largest oil refineries, producing 800,000 barrels of oil per day. At the time, it was under an expansion project to produce up to an astonishing 1.2 million barrels per day. And for confidentiality reasons, the company and details of the project will remain unnamed. I spent each day with 2 to 3 different managers from each department and was able to learn a large portion of each faculty of discipline during my time there. One such day on the refinery stood out in particular. It was a hot, sunny, and humid day. After monsoon rainfall my entire time there. And on that day, a handful of managers thought it would be fun to take me out to the jetty, where they loaded and unloaded the supertankers. Situated a lengthy route away from the refinery itself, we drove down towards the coastline. On our way down there, we drove past many different villages, each one looking extremely impoverished. I learned later that this was not always the case. There was a time in this region where fishing, farming, and the local economy truly flourished. But once the refinery project was approved, among other projects in the region, they built a pipeline directly through 9 different villages. Over a period of time, there was a pipeline breakage which contaminated an underground aquifer and spoiled the wells and water supply of the majority of the surrounding villages. As industry expanded and land was bought and sold, men were forced into cheap labor at the refineries after lifetimes of sustainable farming and fishing, now dependent on 1 or 2 companies for employment. Women, children, and elders went starving after losing access to fresh water, with no accountability for cleanup, just to fend for themselves. I ask, would that be the case here in our region? Do you see any potential similarities? Converging onto a thin strip of man-made road spanning about 2 miles in length, we arrived at the jetty, greeted by military personnel. In the distance, an ultra-large crude carrier fresh from the Middle East was rolling in from the horizon. The size of the vessel stopped me in my tracks. I asked one of the managers, Jitesh was his name, why the ship stopped so far out. He told me that because of the size of the ship, they had a floating unloading station. So we all stood there, suspended in what felt like an eternal moment. The heat waves rising above the calm Arabian Sea, and the ship danced in the horizon as I stood dumbfounded by its sheer mass. One man comments, I always forget just how large those vessels are. A few moments pass as we all stood, just watching. Out of the silence, Jitesh says to me, do you see what we're doing here, Mr. Lee? I asked, what's that, Jitesh? He replied, with an unexpected, sobering tone, we are destroying future generations for now and forever. And in this kind of slow motion life moment, I felt this kind of tingling feeling on the top of my head. And with sweat dripping down from the inside of my hard hat onto my face, the sun beaming into my eyes, I squint over at the 6 managers slowly nodding their heads in silent agreement.
Brain's testimony is available to watch in full on YouTube under the title Oil Executive's Son's Powerful Testimony at the Northern Gateway Pipeline Joint Review. Now we go to an interview recorded on January 3rd for CFRU's Prison Radio about the blockade of rail tracks near Belleville, Ontario, as part of Idle No More.
My name is Dan Doreen. I'm from Pananaga Mohawk Territory, and we've done some stuff here in support of Idle No More, and I guess we can just go on from there.
Yeah, sweet. So do you want to give us some of the background of your experience of what's been happening with Idle No More?
Yeah, Idle No More is a movement that started December 10th, you know, and in support of that, Chief Spence went on a hunger strike on December 11th, and she's like in her 24th day, I think, you know, to get a meeting and talk about treaty rights and, you know, the Bill C-45, which directly violates treaties.
Do you want to sort of talk about the response that's happened in your community to the movement of Idle No More and to Stephen Harper's non-acknowledgement of Chief Spence?
Prime Minister Harper's non-acknowledgement of Chief Spence is just ongoing on what he thinks of Aboriginal women. You know, there's 650 missing Aboriginal women in Canada. You know, the dignity that he has shown to even put an inquiry into the missing and murdered women of in the Aboriginal community is the same indignity that he shows Chief Spence.
So what happened on Sunday?
On Sunday, you know, Chief Spence called for some action to support her and Idle No More and Bill C-45. And so Tinonega decided that we should do something, and we did. You know, we blocked the tracks for 4 hours and disrupted 2,000 passengers and that was just a soft hit.
I guess just in terms of what's happening next, what do you see happening in terms of some sort of building of pressure on the government to actually deal with treaty rights?
The Chiefs of COPE for Day of Action of Economic Disruption on January 16th. It's just going to build momentum, and frustration is just going to get more and more if Chief Harper doesn't acknowledge Chief Wright's request. It's a simple request. It's not hard, and we're gonna give them some power. And instead of going to the table with expecting pity from the government, we're gonna go to the table and we're gonna give our leaders the power to sit at the table, and the power knowing that we can shut this country down.
Why do you think Stephen Harper hasn't acknowledged Chief Spence so far, or hasn't wanted to sit down and talk?
Well, because it's his goal to annihilate Native people and to assimilate them. So if he can sell off our lands and he can open water rights and some environmental aspects that were under protection that aren't under protection now, it's just to annihilate First Nations people and assimilate them as Canadians. You know, First Nations people, this is a movement that is going national, and governments haven't seen this kind of uprising since the Oka crisis. If they're going to continue, then that's the way it's going to be. The movements across the nation and not only Canada, but internationally as well. And I think it's putting pressure on the government, and it's just going to get, it's not going to get any better until government decides to sit down with this country and talk about treaty rights and talk about our existence within Canada.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire from CFRU in Guelph. Thanks for tuning in. This is Erin Hudson. Music this week was by Montreal band Jazz Pad. Headlines this week were written by Erin Hudson. We also thank all the folks at CFRU and in particular Carly Forbes. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.